what she said? I'll move from Bombay all the poor, so there will be no poor in India, Bombay. And Mr. Boris Johnson will do the same. Move all the poor from London and it will be rich London.
People aren't, I feel like we're not doing enough. I feel like we're focused on the wrong things, you know what I mean? On the news every morning it's this and that, you know, there's always another problem and majority of the time it's about COVID or, but yeah, I just feel like there's so many problems at the moment that...
In life you usually just focus on yourself, but you know, it's also nice to think about other people, but you see the people up there, the Prime Minister and stuff, they only think about themselves.
When you're dealing with things like homelessness, just giving them money isn't going to fix the issue. They need to learn what to do with the money, how to make the money stretch for them forever, you know, what to do with investing, pensions, getting jobs, things like that.
Governments are disassociated from people in Britain, and the other issues have become a higher priority, such as sort of economic sustainability and international competitiveness of Britain, rather than there's just no sort of community spirit voting for Labour movements and left-wing movements. There's no collective action anymore.
It is really frustrating. It is really frustrating, and it is really the hamper of the British peoples.
And I do know that, you know, society is complaining, people's complaining.
When I'm walking and if I see, I feel so bad. I mean, you know, I'm lucky enough to have, a shelter on my, head. But when you see the, you know, it's the first world country, developed country, there's no shortage of money. But sadly, those people are sleeping rough, not looked after.
What is the future for the United Kingdom when the streets of its capital have become home for over 10,000 people?
We know this. Like, rich people are getting richer, poor people are getting poorer, which obviously is going to lead to more people being homeless. And the housing in London especially is ridiculous. It's so expensive. How many people can actually afford, you know, to buy a house, to rent a decent place that they can go home? Not many people.
Well, I don't see where we're going. Hopefully I'll be standing and be able to demonstrate about it with no violence. You know, I talk about it. That's all you need to do, you know. Just show the government that this should not happen. You know, people should not sleep outside, especially in this cold weather.
One thing is, I'm also not blaming all the only nation, because some people can work and they should work. And those who cannot, they should get help.
To be honest, I think it'll only get worse. I don't think, you know, hopefully, because like you say, we do have the resources to help these people, you know what I mean? And, you know, they're all, especially at the moment, like you said, I don't know what the number was, but 10,000, you know, people going to sleep, especially, like I said, during winter, it's freezing.
Well, it's either going to increase or it's going to go lower until the Prime Minister does something. And he's not doing much right now.
Although homelessness has gotten worse over the first few years, look back 30, 40 years, maybe even more, it has gotten much better since then. Unemployment has gone down loads and loads. So it is getting better. Like I said, because of how complex it is, it's going to take many, many years.
The future is just to get worse, currently. If it continues down this road, then there will be no momentum or motivation to change anything unless something fundamental changes within the parliamentarian system.
Well, I think there's a lot more than 10,000, to be honest with you. I don't think there is 10,000. I mean, you've only got to go up and down London and you see them on the trains, you see them on the roads.
Unless we have a change in the government, I cannot see anything positive. I think there is a need for a government who would be sympathetic, who would understand the actual issues. If you are living in a mansion, I am not too sure how would you understand the difficulties and issues people facing on the street.
I think it's going to be even more, to be honest. If nothing's going to change, it's going to get worse. Yeah, because the young generation's growing as well. They're struggling to get jobs. They're struggling to get a property or to afford to rent. It's going to get worse, yeah.
Well, it's not sending a good image, if you ask me, but I think the whole world is the same, really. It's not just Britain. But I think it's going to get better. Let's just hope it gets better.
I think I had my time. Perhaps the next generation is going to be getting even tougher time. So, in one hand, the government is borrowing billions and hundreds of billions of pounds. Nobody knows where it's going. But the next generation has to pay. And perhaps, sadly, the homeless people will be the last one to be in the queue to get the help.
Mr. John Sparks, the chief executive of Homeless Charity Crisis, has said, "You cannot free people from the cycle of homelessness without a proper home and, crucially, the support they need to keep it long-term." Amnesty International adds that frontline services warn they are at breaking point due to a rise in homelessness, and that the UK could be facing a human rights catastrophe. At the same time, when it comes to housing difficulties, black households are particularly at risk.
As the UK experiences yet another rise in COVID-19, and as Boris Johnson appears focused on his own survival, his government struggles to solve the homelessness issue. The Prime Minister could himself be evicted from Downing Street. Yet his problems are small compared to being homeless or sleeping rough day after day. But the government's COVID crisis has made it even less able to help one of the most vulnerable groups in the country, people with nowhere to live.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz customs in various nations. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Today you will hear some of the Nowruz traditions and customs among different nations. We hope you will enjoy the program. The vast land of Iran has a very old history and a very rich culture. Although some parts of this land have been separated from the motherland during centuries, many of the cultural features have remained among various ethnicities. Nowruz is among the main features of this vast cultural land and is celebrated in more than 12 countries. Nowruz, corresponding with the vernal equinox, is accompanied with beautiful customs, which have been marked for over 3,000 years. Nowruz is so popular among the world people that in 2010, the United Nations issued a resolution recognizing the day as International Nowruz Day. Nowruz is marked in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, Turkey, India, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and some ethnicities in China. First, let us go to the Republic of Azerbaijan. Nowruz is very spectacular in Azerbaijan. People welcome Nowruz weeks before the coming of spring. They celebrate the four last Tuesdays of the year with happy events. These traditions are held to remember the four ingredients of the earth, namely water, wind, soil, and fire. The Nowruz feast in the capital city of Baku are mostly held in the historical part of the city called Icheri Sheher, or town center. This area is a suitable place for travelers and foreign tourists. Different ceremonies are held there, and local foods, including kebab, are served among the participants. There are a number of kiosks which present different kinds of handicrafts, sweets, and jams. Nowruz is celebrated in many parts of India too. Qamar Abbas, who has lived in Iran for several years, said on Nowruz in his country, "I am Qamar Abbas from the Uttar Pradesh state in northern India. Nowruz is celebrated all over India, yet it is marked mainly by three groups of people. In Kashmir, Nowruz is marked like Iran, and the first day is a holiday in this region. In addition to exchange of visits, like Iran, the people of Kashmir plant trees upon the coming of Nowruz. This custom is marked even by the state government, and this celebration takes 7 days while local foods are served. Nowruz in Kashmir is very much like Iran, therefore, Kashmir is sometimes called Small Iran. Nowruz is also celebrated by Parsis of India. Parsis are originally Iranian Zoroastrians, which have migrated to India centuries ago. Parsis make foods like Iranians. Two of the foods that they commonly make are rice with saffron and halim, which comprises meat, wheat, and other ingredients. They make local foods too. Parsis mainly live in Gujarat state, and the metropolitan city of Mumbai. The Indian Shias also celebrate Nowruz anywhere they are. They spread the special tablecloth and make foods on the basis of the color of the year. In many regions, they sprinkle water on each other, yet these are done only in houses among Shias. Abdurrahim Darrani from Pakistan speaks about Nowruz customs in his country. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I am Abdulrahim Darrani, the manager of Pashto Radio of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I am from the Pakhtunkhwa state in Pakistan. Well, many of the Nowruz traditions and customs are the same as Iran. One of them is the number 7. For instance, in some regions, some foods are made like 7 foods and 7 fruits. As for my region, Peshawar, Ghazalbash people make 7 kinds of sweets. In some regions, they have house cleaning, exchanging of visits, and wearing of new clothes, just like Iran. Yet, some customs are different. But in most regions in Pakistan, such as Kashmir and the state of Gilead, Baltistan, people say that Imam Ali, peace upon him, was introduced as the commander of the faithful by the Prophet on the day of Qadir Khum, which in that year it had corresponded with Nowruz. Thus, they recite special prayers on this day, wear new clothes and play special games resembling polo. In some regions, like Balochistan, on the 13th of Nowruz, people go to the nature to take a rest outdoors. In big cities like Karachi and Lahore, Nowruz is not marked notably. But the people of Kashmir, Gilead, Baltistan and Balochistan mark the event since they are farmers. And spring is the start of everything for farmers. Some people sprinkle water on each other as they believe that water brings light and blessing.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they're not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support, either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as it's usually the norm. But data about what the U.S. troops are doing there has been curiously scarce.
Thank you.
The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the east, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance, at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
U.S. President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the U.S. another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the U.S. and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax. But still, the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights, a lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case. During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy, and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
A major cyber attack has hit websites of different institutions in Israel. A number of websites, including the website of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Military Affairs, were affected. Israeli officials say the ministries of health, welfare were also targeted, as well as the Prime Minister's office. Sources have described the incident as the largest ever cyber attack carried out against Israel.
If what goes around comes around, and after all these years of attacking other people's systems, computer systems, now the Israelis are suffering their own attack.
Internet access advocacy group NetBlox said a significant disruption has been registered on multiple networks supplied by Israel's leading internet providers. There were reports of connectivity interruption across Israel. As of this hour, all the sites are back for activity.
Yeah, it's obvious. Everybody depends on computers now. The problem here is always going to be the problem with irregular warfare. How do you know who did it? Normally, what would happen in a moment like this is that Israel would immediately accuse Iran of doing it, no matter who did it. And then they would call for the United States to bomb Iran, invade Iran, overthrow the government, and so on and so forth. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And now you're seeing, I think, the limits of this cyber warfare because it depends on political considerations.
Earlier this year, a hacker group called Moses' Staff struck Israeli closed-circuit television cameras in the occupied Palestinian territories and Rafael Advanced Defense System, which is an Israeli military technology company. The group released the images, that were apparently taken from CCTV cameras belonging to Rafael Advanced Defense Systems on January 28th in 2021. The group said it had hacked into the closed-circuit television cameras on the streets of the occupied Palestinian territories. Back then, it posted a message regarding the cyber attack on its website, titled, "We See With Your Eyes." In November 2021, Moses' staff announced that it had targeted a number of Israeli firms and acquired a vast trove of critical facilities maps, which included information on the location and characteristics of vital systems across the occupied territories. Moses' staff added that the data included airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and 3-dimensional images of Israeli military sites and important buildings. Moses' staff further stated that the information it had was of immense significance. The group has hacked over 165 servers and 254 websites and compiled over 11 terabytes of data, including Israel Post, the Ministry of Military Affairs, files related to Gantz.
Yes, obviously, if the attack succeeded, they have stronger capabilities. That's obvious. But the bigger question is, who would it be? How are we going to deduce this from the evidence? The logical suspect would be Iran, because Iran has already suffered from numerous Israeli attacks. The Israelis even made a movie about it, a miniseries called Tehran, which is all about hacking the Iranian computer system.
The Electron Silag Company and Epsilor Company. Israel has been the source of tension in the Middle East region for decades. It has carried out numerous assassinations in different countries, including Iran. It's also responsible for actual physical attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. Iran has always stressed that Israel's crimes and attacks will not go unpunished, and the cyber field appears to be a new arena for this fight.
Felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. The Holy Prophet began his astonishing migration to Medina, followed by other Muslims. Little by little, the immigrants arrived in that city. Before the migration, the Holy Prophet sent an emissary to Yathrib, Medina. He sent Mus'ab ibn Umair as his representative so that he would recite Quranic verses for the people. So he laid the groundwork. Later, the Prophet himself migrated to Yathrib and established the Islamic government. That was the pinnacle of the Holy Prophet's movement. And he was not satisfied with the mere formation of a government and the mere rule over the people. He also began to confront the enemies in a comprehensive manner, because the enemies would not leave Muslims alone. He formed an army, prepared warfare and attacked the enemies. In certain places, he engaged in defense, and in certain other places, he engaged in attack. He did both. Some people claim that the Holy Prophet's wars had only a defensive nature, but this was not the case. Some had a defensive and some had an offensive nature, according to the circumstances. Subsequently, he encountered the base of polytheism, which was Mecca. He conquered that city and God's house became accessible to Islam and Muslims. So he gave stability to the Islamic government. This is the most stimulating part of the Islamic movement. How do the promoters of this viewpoint want to separate Islam and religion from government?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next point about Ba'atha is that one of the most important slogans and positions of the Holy Prophet was confronting jahiliyyah, ignorance. In the Holy Quran, ignorance has been censured many times. Jahiliyyah, or ignorance, whose meaning I will explain later, has been disparaged many times in the Holy Quran. In Surah Al-Ma'idah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Do they then seek after a judgment of the days of ignorance?" Chapter 5, verse 15. And in Surah Al-Ahzab, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And make not a dazzling display like that of the former times of ignorance." Chapter 33, verse 33. In Surah Al-Fath, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "While the unbelievers got up in their hearts the heat and verbiage of ignorance." Chapter 48, verse 26. This has been mentioned in other Quranic ayahs, verses as well. But I remember these three ayahs, which I have written down.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity marking the first day of spring and the renewal of nature. Nowruz, a legacy from thousands of years ago, always energizes people celebrating the event to observe many customs.
Nowruz promotes values of peace and solidarity within families and across generations. It is believed to be a key contributor to cultural diversity and friendship among different communities.
Days before the arrival of Nowruz, Iranians hastily do backlogs and go shopping to embrace the turn of the Persian year, with a lot of ceremonial customs waiting to be observed. Iranians get prepared for Nowruz by cleaning their house, a custom known as Khana Tekani. Dusting and cleaning home appliances and furniture, washing rugs and etc. are just parts of the house cleaning process. Moreover, the Nowruz festivity has a symbolic item unique to this tradition, Sofia Haftsin. The Haftsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there is a history behind each element, including serke, or vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, somek is a symbol of love and compassion, sib, or apple, is said to represent health and fertility, senjad, or silver berry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection, sabze, or sprout, symbolizes rebirth, sir, or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction, and samanu represents affluence.
Iranians spend the night of Nowruz with their family. The traditional New Year dinner is fish with rice and herbs. Many families give a money gift called Eidi to the children to mark the New Year. People often visit each other's homes and always bring traditional gifts.
Nowruz provides a good opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz has been regarded as the feast of unification. The celebration of Nowruz needs a happy ending to make it perfect. So on the last day of this celebration, people go outdoors to celebrate the end of the Nowruz holidays. The last day of Nowruz holidays is called Sizdabedar, or 13 Day Out, which is also called Nature's Day.
Nowruz is a time for family and friends to gather and celebrate the end of one year and the beginning of the next. Preparing for Nowruz starts a few weeks before the new year with the traditional spring cleaning of the home. At this time, it is also customary to purchase new clothing and new furniture for the home.
In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. It is now widely known to be a symbol of peace to many people.
Nowruz is reminiscent of renewal and a new life. It's something beyond a mere festival. It's a culture which introduces a human civilization. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Refugees are welcome here. The most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist, state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be, like, considered as worthy of empathy. And we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, and, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation, and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against the Semitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza. And we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States and its key ally, the UK, launched the Iraq War in 2003 with a strike against a location where then-Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and his top commanders were believed to be meeting. But that was not an abrupt attack, as Washington and London had already begun intensifying their military build-ups in the Persian Gulf beforehand. U.S. President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair repeatedly indicated that the assault was imminent and aimed to destroy Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. But neither UN inspectors nor intelligence services could ever find such weapons in Iraq.
None of those pretexts were really help us explain the overall project that the U.S. had in this region.
Ironically, Washington and London gave little heed to calls to allow the inspections process be given more time. Saddam, a once ally who had the full support of the U.S. and Western countries during his eight-year war against Iran, had finally grown too defiant for the U.S. to tolerate. The Iraq War, estimated to have cost the U.S. nearly $5.5 trillion and over 4,500 deaths among its servicemen. For Iraqis, the cost was much higher. More than 1 million people were killed and millions displaced, while millions more continue to face insecurity and poverty. Birth defects and cancer rates also sharply increased as foreign forces used depleted uranium weapons in civilian areas. 19 years on since the U.S.-led invasion, the war agents are yet to be charged for any of their crimes.
War on Iraq was one of 8 wars in West Asia and North Africa, which the U.S. was carrying out in service of its plans to create a so-called New Middle East, where the entire region would be under the tutelage of the U.S. and its key allies, Israel and the Saudis.
The U.S. announced ending its combat mission in 2011, but 3 years later it started boosting deployment again, this time under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Throughout recent years, there have been multiple reports of Washington's nexus with the Takfiri terrorists, while Iraqis, with the help of the regional resistance front, were fighting themselves to eliminate Daesh.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster, RT, stripped of its broadcasting license in the UK.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Ratansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems, like of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government, peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RTE falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Saeed Puriza, London.
The outrage was palpable at today's protest. A Freedom of Information request revealed this week that racism was a factor in the Metropolitan Police's horrific strip search of a schoolgirl known as Child Q in 2020. She was forced to bend over for two female police officers to look at her private parts. No other trusted adult was present and her parents weren't informed. The Met officers are now under investigation.
Some assert that the strip search of Child Q was an isolated incident, a crime perpetrated by a few bad apples. But members of the community disagree.
I think this feels a systematic approach that the police use. They may now regret using it in this particular instance. They may say that. How people could conceptualise strip searching a girl in school without her mum knowing about it, without an adult present, it's just heartbreaking.
Child Q has launched legal proceedings against the Metropolitan Police and her school. Many prominent figures have offered their support. The school called the police on Child Q, saying she smelt of marijuana. The strip search yielded no evidence of her being in possession of drugs.
They're out here in the streets in our schools to defend their interests. They're out here to discipline us, to create and sow and violently enforce the divisions that the ruling class needs in order to rule us and oppress us.
Now black families are torn on how to safeguard their children, to make them aware of the dangers without terrifying them of going to school.
I had to take my children out of a previous school because the black children are being treated different than the white children in schools in London, in England. And that needs to stop. I have girls a similar age to this woman, to this young woman that it's happened to, and I'm so emotional about it that I can't even speak about it.
I used to work with children in homes, looked after children, and sometimes the children would complain that they were abused in the station. They ain't got no trust for the police, they ain't got no trust for society, for social care, they ain't got no trust anymore.
Horrified but not surprised, that was the reaction of many here today. In the past 5 years, more than 172,000 strip searches have been conducted in London, and the statistics show black people are three times more likely to be targeted. There were mothers, aunties and educators at today's protest, vowing to protect their youth. But with police being called into schools and parents alerted after the fact, how can they? Bianca Rahimi, London.
From Kurdish horses to Kurdish music and dance, this festival is all about showcasing the traditions of Iran's province of Kurdistan in celebrating the Persian New Year known as Nowruz.
I wish you a happy Nowruz. I hope that the New Year will be treating you well and the COVID pandemic will be over.
I welcome all of my fellow Iranian citizens who have come to visit Sanandaj. I wish them health and wealth in the new year.
The ceremony also saw Iranians coming from other provinces, both to get acquainted with the Kurdish culture and to showcase their own customs in celebrating Nowruz.
We've come from Sistan and Baluchistan province. I'm so glad to see all Iranian ethnicities have happily gathered here to celebrate Nowruz.
I congratulate you on Nowruz. I'm from Khorasan province and today I watched the Kurdish dance and it was amazing.
Nowruz marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, which falls on March 21st. The ancient tradition is celebrated by some 300 million people in Iran, Tajikistan and Afghanistan, among other countries. That's why this event has also hosted activists from other countries.
Hello.
I congratulate the arrival of